Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 27th of April. We're going to talk about the railroads this hour of the program. The 140th anniversary of the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad approaches on May 10. And the railroad industry is gaining a lot of interest from American businesses and politicians. We've gone through waves of loving the railroad and having it be a fabulous form of transportation for goods and for people, to having it fall out of favor. And now, with all this talk about high-speed rail and the possibility of using freight tracks to revamping them to relieve truck congestion on America's highways, all of these issues are being discussed. So the railroad is back in favor in this country, and both of our guests this hour believe that that's a good thing. We'll have two guests with us. The first half hour, our guest from the New America Foundation, author of The Next Progressive Era, A Blueprint for Broad Prosperity, who's written some very interesting things about trains and freight, particularly. Later in the hour, the director of corporate communications for Eurostar, which is the high-speed passenger train operating between the UK and Europe. Philip Longman is our guest now. Schwartz, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, author of many articles and books on demographics, economics, finance, healthcare, and social change. His latest book is entitled The Next Progressive Era, A Blueprint for Broad Prosperity. He's testified before Congress on proposals for revamping America's transportation system and has written extensively on this issue. We're very happy to have Phil with us this first half hour. Our number is 800-486-8655 for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Phil. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here, Kathleen.
So tell me about your ideas for freight on the increasing freight on the rail. It's a really interesting proposal in lessening up congestion on the highways, and rails actually could be important in a whole lot of areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the best way to get the concept across is to talk about a concrete example. So I'll do that quickly, to talk about a concrete example.
Sure.
And the one I'll use is Interstate I-81, which is a road that runs basically from Canadian border in upstate New York down to near Roanoke, Virginia. And this road doesn't pass through any major cities, and yet it's overwhelmed by truck traffic. And the reason is because I-95, which is the main interstate north-south from Maine to Florida, is so overwhelmed by trucks that truckers will divert all the way to this I-81 and gets to the point where one out of four vehicles on the road is a truck.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? So, and it's also a hilly road, so it's half the time you're passing the trucks and half the time they're passing you. It's a very dangerous road. And so officials in the states that goes through have been thinking, well, what can we do about it? We can't accommodate this truck traffic. The first order of thinking was, well, we'll build more lanes because that's what state highway departments do. But it turns out that's just outrageously expensive. And then the next thought was, well, how about we put tolls on this road? And when that proposal was floated, there was this huge firestorm, so that's not going to happen. And then somebody got smart and noticed that right alongside this interstate is a rail line that's seeing an increase in traffic. But for various reasons, the railroad that owns it doesn't have the access to capital it needs to improve this line and make it fast enough so that more trucks would divert from the highway to the interstate. So in a nutshell, the idea here is to use money that would otherwise be going to build more lanes on this particular highway and using it to invest in improving this rail capacity with a very strong quid pro quo for the public that when it increases the rail capacity for the railroad, it gets to share that capacity in the form of commuter trains and high-speed trains for passengers. And that in a nutshell is what the proposal is. They're all over the country. There are these different choke points. The one closest to Wisconsin is Chicago, where for historical reasons the tracks don't quite line up coming from the east and coming from the west. And so while a container of freight can go from New York to Chicago in 48 hours, it takes another 48 hours to take it off the train, rubber wheel it across the city, and put it back on another train to go on the other side.
Oh, my.
You know, and anybody who knows Chicago traffic knows how bad that is. So it's just a new way of looking at how we deploy our transportation dollars. There are all kinds of amazing upsides. Trains are as much as 20 times more efficient in energy. Even with current technology, the railroads can move a ton of freight all the way across the country with 7 gallons of diesel fuel. So we get less highway congestion, a better driving, safer driving experience for passenger cars, lower pollution, less energy dependence, et cetera.
So the reason, I find it ironic that people are looking at this rail system right next to this very congested highway, which seems very obvious to me that, oh, well, maybe we got to look at this rail system, is that we are so in love with the automobiles and we just all over the country think about, well, if we've got congestion, we just add another lane?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we do instinctively?
That's what we do more often or not, or just endure the congestion.
Right.
But importantly here, you know, unlike with high-speed passenger rail, this proposal isn't trying to price or guilt trip people out of their automobiles. If anything, it improves the driving experience. So we don't have to have this culture war about whether this is a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Wisconsin listeners will, some of them might be old enough to remember this rhythmically named Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific Railroad, whose remnants still go across the state. 100 years ago, that railroad, which went on to cross the Rockies and Cascade Mountains, 100 years ago, it was electrified using hydropower. And so they had electric engines hauling 100-car trains over the Continental Divide. Now think about what that is. That's a zero-emission system, right?
Right.
Totally renewable, right? It could be done again today. Probably the most sensible use for wind power is to power passing trains, because you know the big complaint about wind power now is that the wind isn't where the people are, and then when you put these high tension wires in, you lose a lot of energy just getting the power to the people. If you use the wind instead to move your freight across the windy parts of the country, you don't have that problem. So we have enormous potential here to make our transportation, our freight transportation, really green.
Right. In addition to reducing carbon monoxide significantly, you also write in a recent article about this that if we used the rails for mail delivery, if we used the rails for sometimes food delivery from the West Coast to the East Coast, everything would get there a lot faster.
Yes, faster, less labor-intensive. In part, this comes down to just the basic physics of steel wheels on steel rails. A train has about one-tenth the rolling resistance that a truck does, and just because of the way of the physics of it work, the more you load up a train, the more efficient it gets compared to other modes. So you can haul heavy stuff really, really cheap. And again, even as recently as 50 or 60 years ago, it wasn't uncommon for a family to ship its refrigerator to a lakeside summer cottage by Railroad Express Agency, because when you're using rail, the weight is almost incidental. You compare that to, you know, those of us have to pay $50 to bring our dirty clothes home on the airlines. So there are all kinds of other applications. You think about what it means to send a FedEx letter from New York to Chicago. Well, the first thing that's going to happen is they're going to fly it to Memphis and they're going to sort it like mad all night and then fly another plane to Chicago. Well, again, 100 years ago, you could, for 5 or 2 cents, mail a letter at 5 o'clock in New York and have it in Chicago the next morning, because they used mail clerks on the trains who did all the sorting, and the train beat the plane even to this day. So, you know, there's another tremendous opportunity for reducing carbon imprint.
Sure. You write that railroads have gone from having too much track to not having enough. Today, the nation's rail network is just 94,942 miles, less than half, which I find astounding, less than half of what it was in 1970, and yet it is hauling 137% more freight.
Right, right. The rails have come back. And, you know, the big trucking companies now are looking to put as many containers as they can on trains, but again, the capacity isn't there. United Parcel Service would like to use the rails to do four-day delivery across the country, which they now do with team tags of drivers. It's incredibly expensive. For a brief time, they ran a train that was fast enough to do it in 4 days, but because of lack of track, the slower trains couldn't get out of the way, and the whole Union Pacific Railroad froze up for months, and so we don't do that anymore. Our listeners might wonder, well, you know, if their railroads are getting all this business back, why don't they take some of their profits and put it into capital investment? And the answer is they are doing some of this. They're doing a lot of it. But I think it's now easier for us to understand in the wake of the Wall Street meltdown that Wall Street isn't always rational in how it allocates funds. And so the railroads for years have been pleading for Wall Street investment to do things like electrify and add double tracks and other things like that. And the answer came back from global capital markets, no, we think we have a better idea. We'll put it in all the world savings into overpriced track housing. You know, at some point, you just can't rely on the financial markets to make the right decision here, especially because so many of the upsides of this proposal are in the nature of a public good. There's 5,000 people killed every year in truck accidents, right? That's a public good. Wall Street's indifferent to that. They're indifferent to global warming, et cetera.
Right. We're going to start taking phone calls for you. We have an email that has come in. Is it true that freight rail is the only transportation industry not supported by the federal government?
Yes. They pay for their own infrastructure. They pay property taxes. They pay for all their own rolling stock. There have been periods when large railroads went bankrupt and the government came in and bailed at least two of them out. In the Conrail episode, but now the industry as a whole is profitable and paying taxes rather than consuming them like highways do.
Let's welcome phone calls for Philip. Philip Longman is our guest the first half hour of the show. We're looking at railroads this hour of the program, and he is from the New America Foundation, author of The Next Progressive Era, a blueprint for broad prosperity, has testified frequently before Congress on transportation needs for this country. Our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. He's written an interesting piece appearing in the Washington Monthly, Back on Tracks. And the email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Philip Longman, our guest this first half hour, the second half hour, the director of corporate communications from Eurostar, which is the high-speed passenger train that operates between the UK and Europe. Let's go to Mike from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I just want to say I entirely support your guest's viewpoint. And I'm sorry. I want to thank you for taking my call. But with rail, with transport of goods, and also of people, I believe it's entirely necessary in the future, considering air pollution from planes. Thank you, and I will hang up at this point.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. Phil?
As we go more environmentally conscious, I think we turn to rail because so much good can come of it on that front. I think it's important to remind people who might be a little more skeptical that the way this actually works nowadays is freight is put into containers, they're called. They're like giant boxes. And you can take that box and you can put it on a boat and you can put it on a train or you can put it on a truck and haul it around. And the real gain comes in using these different modes of transportation cooperatively. Each one has their advantages. Trucks can go places that trains can't. Trains are more energy efficient, right? So the basic vision is that we use trucks to haul these containers to the nearest railhead and then get them on the train as quickly as possible for wherever they're going. We'll still need truckers to perform that function, and in for some short hauls, you'll still need trucks. But we have we've partnered with a Millennium Institute to do some econometric modeling, and we think that we can get 83% of all the trucks off the road by 2030, and get a 15% reduction in oil consumption and a 39% reduction in CO2 emissions. So, some hard studies gone into this. Many of these proposals have been studied since the 70s and were shelved when people lost interest in their in fixing the energy crisis. So a lot of this is shovel-ready, and it's all shovel-worthy.
Let's go to Michael next from Milwaukee. Hello, Michael.
Yes. Hi, Kathleen, and hi, Philip. How are you today?
Okay.
Good, good. Hey, it's so refreshing and uplifting to hear a fellow talk some sense about transportation. We all know that trains, I don't know the specifics on how much less energy it takes to transport goods by train versus truck, but we're all with you on that one. I was wondering, why don't we see more trains nowadays? It seems like we're seeing less trains. Some of the tracks have been abandoned, and why don't we see more trains now?
Well, in some places you do. If you were along the tracks of the old Santa Fe Railroad until the recent recession, you would have seen a lot of more trains.
Okay.
They've tended to take a lot of little branch lines out and put all the long-distance trains on a few trunk lines. So where there are trains, there's lots of them, usually. Sad to say, the recession has knocked everybody's traffic way down. I went across the country by train a couple weeks ago, and there's miles after miles of empty freight cars across the Nebraska Plain just sitting out there. So for now, we don't have quite the congestion problems, but we will have them back quickly. You probably noticed there's fewer trucks on the highway, too, recently.
Yeah.
Right. But, it's coming back, and we need to address these issues.
Anything else,
okay,
Michael?
I have one more question, if I could, real quick.
Of course.
Okay. We have a limited amount, I would imagine, of railroad right-of-way. Now, under our president's proposal, he's in favor of trains and more. I mean, we're talking about high-speed trains, et cetera. That's great, too. Do we have enough right-of-way to make these new contrivances happen?
Yeah, I think we do. I mean, we lost some national treasures in the 70s, but there were a few far-sighted people who did something called rail banking. So a lot of places you might find a bike trail is on a line, but that line is, by prearrangement, it can be put back into rail service. The bicyclists might not like that, and there might be a bit of a fight about it. Also, we have this new computer technology is coming in called positive train control, which means that you can run trains much closer to each other and much faster and much more safely. So by marrying this ancient technology, steel wheel on steel rail, with computers, you can increase capacity tremendously at relatively low cost. That's something you can't do on a highway, right? A computer-driven highway, that's pretty Buck Rogers, but doing it on a railroad is not so hard.
Thank you, Michael.
In
a moment, we'll be talking with somebody from Eurostar. Is there anything beyond the reason, well, Europe is much closer, the countries are close together, and that's why they have such a stellar train system and we don't? Is there something more to explain why Europe is so far ahead of the United States on this?
Yeah, I think there is, and it's a bit arcane, but it has to do with this way we finance highways. The old auto industrial complex was very shrewd back in the day when they managed to get all gas taxes dedicated to building highways. And that allows the illusion that, highways aren't subsidized, but they are. Imagine if all cigarette taxes went back into making cigarette factories and encouraging more people to smoke, right? In Europe, they pay for transportation out of general revenues, particularly in France. And so there's no one mode that's disadvantaged over another, and people can sort of rationally figure out in case-by-case basis what makes sense where. But as it stands now, for more than 100 years, we've had this tremendous bias in the way we make transportation decisions.
Let's go to Larry from Milwaukee next. Hello, Larry.
Yes, thank you for the show, and thank all your supporters out there. Say, I have an idea like a park and ride where you would actually go like from Milwaukee to Salt Lake City and put your vehicle on the flatbed on the train, and that would be the express that might stop at the Twin Cities and the larger cities, or I could get on the train that would stop at every tiny shade tree stop along the way. Mm-hmm. And once I was there, I could get from Salt Lake and drive my hour to wherever I needed to go rather than spending 1,600 hours or 1,600 miles on the road and fuel and so forth to get out there.
That's right, and you can have all your camping gear and all that stuff, too, which you can't take on the plane.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, Amtrak runs a service from the Washington area to Florida that allows you to take the train or your car on the train, and then you stay in a passenger car, sleeper car, if you like. And that's actually quite successful. It's kind of a niche market because of all the so-called snowbirds that go down for the winter and want their cars with them. But if we upgraded this infrastructure and committed to, you know, more sensible energy policies, you know, so-called auto trains would make sense in a lot of markets, including the one you just described. Because who wants to be just staring behind a wheel forever when you could just roll your car up in Minneapolis and retire and wake up, you know, in the Rocky Mountains?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, I'm all for it.
Okay.
It's a hard crowd.
Thanks. Thanks very much for the call. Bruce is next from West Milwaukee. Hello, Bruce.
Yes, where are our high-speed trains? I came back from Great Britain and went from Milwaukee to Madison, and I was just in shock that so much oil was being consumed and it was so congested. And, you know, I don't understand why the interstate right-of-ways are not being used for high-speed or even light rail between cities. It could be electrified very easily, and it could use wind power and other kinds of solar power along the route. Mm-hmm. There's this legacy of the highway defense system that was constructed in the 50s, as we all know, which is why we're all addicted to automobiles. You know, and obviously there are problems with long-term investment. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a financial structure that wants short-term returns instantly, and they are unwilling to invest in the long-term investments needed to do rail, whether it's passenger or freight. But I worked on these projects to build high-speed rail here in Wisconsin, and they have been shelved for decades. So I'm sort of like crazed on the topic. But, you know, how is this going to get leveraged? How is it actually going to happen? How is Obama going to does he have to declare a state of emergency to get funding, long-term funding for rail?
Well, there is some funding in the pipeline for high-speed rail as part of the stimulus bill. It's not anywhere near what is for highways. It is, for those of us who followed this issue for years, it's impressive in one dimension in that for the first time rail gets something. but I was enervated when I actually picked up the report that they issued last week and looked at the details, and basically it's they're not breaking any new ground on anything substantial for at least a year. The whole report's just describing meeting cycles, which is an irony because, as you well know, if you worked on these projects, they've been studied and studied and studied, and we know what corridors would make sense, and it's it really does not require future study. the biggest obstacle, and the report actually mentions this, is that there's very few people left in the United States who know anything about passenger rail, and a lot of ones that are around are getting elderly, so time is ticking. We don't have the capacity anymore to build our own high-speed trains. We'd probably have to import them at least at first.
Well, you're right. I have retired, and I worked on the route between Milwaukee and Madison. There's no one who really knows anything about it, and you've got this highway lobby that's, you know, here in the Midwest, they're widening the route between Chicago and Milwaukee. That ought to be spent on high-speed rail, not on widening lanes, but that's a shovel-ready project, which is going ahead. That money ought to be diverted to rail transportation, but that's not going to happen. So,
right.
You know, it's like it's going to take a generation. You've got to train a whole new set of people in rail technology, and you're right, it's going to have to come from Europe. So,
yeah, I think the part of the good news here is you mentioned generational change. There's generational change within the railroad industry itself. So for historical reasons, rail management didn't want any public money, just flat out. They were worried about the loss of control over their own business. And government has been pretty rough on railroads during certain periods of American history. Mm-hmm. But now I think there's a new attitude, and at least on a case-by-case basis, you can look for the railroads to partner. And then now let's remember that the trucking companies are now the railroad's biggest customers, mm-hmm. and so the special politics of freight transportation is different than it was in the old days. So I see a lot of opportunity of new coalitions of people that are worried about global warming and land use patterns and sprawl and such, getting together with a new generation of rail management and people worried about logistics. So I think there is hope here.
Thank you so much for the call, sure. Bruce, and we will follow your advice and go to Europe for some discussion about train technology, rail track technology. Where would you recommend, Phil, that we go for further information? I would direct people to the Washington Monthly to read your article. Is there some other publication or some website that would give us more information about rail transportation?
Yeah, I have a white paper worked up that's more detailed than the Washington Monthly piece, and that can be found at www.newamerica.net.
Okay.
And then if you look under the tabs for blogs and publications, it's listed under Big Ideas.
Great.
So that'll get you to it pretty fast. Google will probably get you there, too.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Take care now.
Yeah, you too. We go to Europe now for our next conversation with Simon Montague, who's Director of Corporate Communications for Eurostar. He joined the company in 2006 and is responsible for managing external and internal communications with the media, stakeholders, and staff. He was a transport correspondent for BBC News from 1997 to 2004. So as a former journalist and a civil engineer, he's been involved with transport and travel for more than 20 years. As you know, Eurostar is the high-speed rail service that links the UK to France and Belgium via the Channel Tunnel. And it started operating in 1994. It has expanded, and it's very, very fast and quite efficient. And, Simon, we are very happy to have you with us. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure to be with you. Tell me, was there any debate? We debate rail systems or we ignore them here in the United States. Was the Eurostar service from the UK to Europe something that was much debated in your country, or was everybody ready to go with it right off the bat?
Well, there's quite a difference between the UK and France because, of course, the Eurostar service runs between the two capitals, London and Paris. The French method very much is to get on with it, and as many of your listeners may be aware, the French have had high-speed trains now for more than 25 years. It is a country of broadly the same population as Britain, but it is about three times the size, and that does mean, of course, there is more room to build high-speed lines, as well as a planning process which enables it to happen more quickly. I have to say, in Britain, a bit like the United States, we did talk about it for an awful long time, although perhaps you might think not that long, but it did actually take us 13 years from the opening of the Channel Tunnel to actually complete Britain's first high-speed line. But we do now have the thing, and it works extremely well.
It's very fast, isn't it? Can you give me some of the speed indications from London to Brussels or to Paris?
Well, the normal running speed is 186 miles an hour. That's
wow.
100 kilometers an hour. I was lucky enough actually to be on a train and we set a new UK speed record of 208 miles an hour. So by no means the fastest train in the world, but on the other hand, I think rather an awful lot faster than anything in the Americas.
It sure is. Do you feel like you're going that? I've never been on one. Do you feel like you're going that fast when you're on it?
Well, the great thing, of course, is high-speed lines often follow the route of what we call motorways, what you might call interstates. Typical traffic speed on a UK motorway is supposed to be 70 miles an hour. Many people drive at 80 or 90, which is probably quite alarming enough for you to hear that those kind of numbers in the US. But, of course, if you're on a train that's doing 200, you're leaving the cars on the road beside you absolutely standing.
Yeah, you sure are. Now, I understand that the rail, tracks were different in France than what you have in London? You had to have different sets of tracks put down, or...?
No, that's not quite right. The distance between the two rails is the same in the UK as it is in France. Where the difference can come between European countries is usually things like platform height or how big the tunnels need to be in order to accommodate the width or the height of the actual carriage itself. But no, I mean, the track distance is exactly the same. It does mean that we've had to build very special trains to run between London and France because they have to run on four different power systems and four different signalling systems, as well, of course, as be safe to operate beneath the English Channel in a tunnel that's 30 miles long. But having said all that, I don't think anyone in the US should get too worried about these technical difficulties for our particular service. It would be a lot easier in the US. You only need to have one power system, one signalling system, and presumably you don't have to worry too much about long tunnels under the sea.
Right. Tell us about the Tread Lightly environmental program that Eurostar has and how much you've been able to reduce carbon emissions.
Well, I guess this is very relevant, and it was interesting to hear Bruce a couple of minutes ago talking about why not use wind power and so on. One of the great advantages of high-speed trains is that, unlike cars and trucks, they're powered by electricity. And the great thing about electricity is, if you like, it is future-proofed. You can get it from wherever you like. You can get it from a coal-fired power station or a nuclear power station, or perhaps in due course from solar or wind-generated or whatever. So as lower carbon forms of electricity come on stream, so you can in turn reduce the carbon or the carbon dioxide that is created by high-speed rail travel. So this is one of the unique things about high-speed trains. Being electrically powered, not only can they be very low carbon to start with, there's a lot of nuclear power, for instance, in France, but they can become even lower carbon as you get these renewable forms of electricity on stream in the next few decades.
And it turns out that in many instances, it may be faster than traveling by plane, right? Considering the check-in time and the time it takes to get to a city center. These go right to the city center, and it's pretty speedy.
Kathleen, there's absolutely no question of that. We've done studies looking around the world at the effect of introducing high-speed rail between two cities, and what does it mean for whether people continue to fly or whether they switch to the train. We have now, between London and Paris, something like 75% market share, and that's absolutely typical for what is roughly a two-hour rail journey between the two cities. I mean, the distance between Chicago and Milwaukee, if I've got it right, is less than 100 miles. That's a train journey you would do in Europe in, 40 minutes? And that's from city centre to city centre. So as soon as you get this kind of change, people switch very quickly. And once they switch, you can look at high-speed rail all around the world. People never go back to flying again.
Isn't that something? No, I'm sure they probably don't. So tell me, as we consider this very slowly in the United States, have you been invited to come over and tell us how to put this together?
We've certainly had one or two offers, yes, and I guess if we could find the time, we'd be delighted to do so. But Eurostar is a train operator. We're not actually a builder of high-speed lines, but we certainly would very much encourage people from the United States who might be taking a holiday in Europe to try high-speed rail, because it's something that, you know, the U.S. leads the world in many, many things, but it doesn't lead the world in rail services, far from it. And if you come and try this stuff, whether it's in the U.K. or France or Spain or Italy, you'll discover something which I think, frankly, will blow your socks off, that you really can travel from city center to city center so quickly with so little hassle. You'll get a punctuality rate of perhaps 90-95% of all trains on time. That's something the airlines simply can't match. And you'll go back to the United States and go, gee, I really wish we had this. This stuff really works in Europe.
Let's go to some phone calls, starting with Dave from Madison. Hi, Dave. Are you there, Dave, still? Yeah, Dave is not there. Oh, I got the wrong line. Forgive me. This should be Dave. Hi, Dave. Dave, are you there? I'm sorry. I don't know what's going on here. Frank from Green Bay. Hello, Frank.
Hi there.
Hi.
I wanted to make the point that high-speed rail in Europe, and I recently traveled from Brussels to London on Eurostar, and it was very smooth and very fast. But they connect to regional rail networks, which operate at lower speeds. And while we should be supporting high-speed rail in the States, we should also be supporting to make sure that the lower-speed regional connections come in as well. And I'm secretary of a group which is just established in Green Bay called New Rails for Northeast Wisconsin. And we only launched in early March, and we've already got 800 people on our mailing list who signed up to support reintroducing rail at a speed of about 80 miles an hour between Green Bay and Milwaukee, and hopefully it'll get up to about 110 miles an hour reasonably quickly. So I just wanted to make the point that it's not just high-speed rail that we need to support. We also got to support the regional connections that go with it.
Simon.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree with that. And one of the things which Eurostar has been doing in the United Kingdom is introducing rail fares which enable people to go from a city in the north of England, perhaps somewhere like York or Cambridge, and then connect with Eurostar to make an onward journey to Brussels, the capital of Belgium, or across to Paris. It is absolutely the case that you need to connect, if you like, the slow or the regional railway systems, the traditional, the classic systems, with the high-speed systems, because people want the flexibility to be able to go not just between two capital cities, but to other cities as well. And, of course, the regional railway networks then feed the high-speed service and vice versa. So, yes, I totally agree with Frank.
Thanks, Frank, very much for your call. We go next to Phil from Gordon Lake. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Really interesting show. I used to live in the Twin Cities, and I know that they're struggling there with the dilemma of their airport, you know, being overcrowded and relatively close to the downtown at this point. And they've been looking at, like, having to build a new airport, like, 60 miles north of the Twin Cities. And, you know, if there was high-speed rail between Minneapolis and Chicago, I think, you know, they would be able to continue with the...
Mm-hmm.
I rode the Trégrand Vitesse in France, gosh, over 20 years ago, from the south of France to Paris, and it was just amazing. You keep, when you start to go down a little hill, you know, you reach for your seatbelt like you would on an airplane because you feel it starting to descend, you know. although there are no seatbelts, of course. It's just the reaction. It's that fast. And I think that if this was established, this kind of service was established, then you'd see a lot more rail travel on lines that weren't so fast that fed into it as well.
Sure. Simon.
Yes, it's interesting, Phil, talking about an airport that's 60 miles north of a city. So when you start to think about making a journey from that airport, and say you live in downtown, you've got, what, a journey of well over an hour to get to the airport. Then you've got to maybe park a car somewhere before you go into the airport. Then you've got to go through a check-in process. It might be, what, 2, 3, maybe even more hours before your aeroplane actually leaves the ground. Well, in that time, on many routes in Europe, in France, in Spain, and, of course, between London and Paris, you've already finished the journey. You haven't even started it with an airport that's 60 miles out of town. This is the kind of difference that high-speed rail can make. And I think you're also, just to pick up one other point that Bruce was talking a few minutes ago about now, is how do you actually justify the expenditure in high-speed rail? It's important not just to think about it in terms of the passengers who would actually buy tickets. You need to think about it in terms of, would it relieve capacity and congestion on the interstates between cities? Would it relieve congestion on airports? What benefits would it bring to other transport modes which are already overloaded? What economic benefits might there be to cities? How might it help the regeneration of rundown inner city areas? So when you're thinking about investing in a high-speed line, you need to think about all of these things, not just transport benefits, but economic benefits, regeneration benefits, and so on, in order to really build an economic case, which the governments can then support.
Since you have so much of the business between the UK and Europe, are air ports, airlines upset with you that you've taken their business? Would they counter a desire to build high-speed rail in this country, do you think?
I don't know. I guess they try to ignore us at the moment. I mean, I guess if airports weren't so overcrowded in Europe, perhaps they might be more upset with us because we would have taken away their customers and they wouldn't have any other customers to replace them with. But the thing with a lot of European airports is they're already very crowded, particularly in the United Kingdom. The airlines have cut back the number of services they run between London and Paris and London and Brussels. But, of course, there's so much pent-up demand to go to other locations that if they cut a service to one city, they can quickly introduce a completely different service to another city, perhaps even a long-haul service, which might be more profitable than the short-haul service that it replaces.
Joining us this half hour as we talk about high-speed rail is Simon Montague, Director of Corporate Communications for Eurostar, the high-speed passenger train that operates between the UK and Europe. And he is a civil engineer and a former journalist, has been involved with transport and travel for more than 20 years. Our phone number, one line is open, is 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, it's talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we return to your phone calls for Simon. Mary is next from Shorewood. Hi, Mary.
Hello, Kathleen and guests. I've had the wonderful opportunity over the last year to take Amtrak from Milwaukee to Minneapolis several times, and it is an absolute delight. And one of the interesting things that I've heard up and down the train car, people talking on their cell phones, talking to people saying what a great alternative this is to air travel, how much more comfortable it is, the fact that they can actually get up and walk around and move to a different car for, you know, if it's a lounge car or what have you. In the summer, they offer the Rails for Trails guides, giving you information about where you're traveling, which is just absolutely fantastic. But the trains need work. Several times we've had situations where the electrical systems they're shot. Some of the seats are falling apart. They need help. And although I really love the idea of the high speed, I think we also need to look at maintaining what we do have, upgrading that. And I'd love to hear your guest comments on that. And I'll take your response offline. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call, Mary. And because you wouldn't be familiar with that system, or maybe for some reason you are, Simon, but tell me about keeping trains operating well with Eurostar and whether or not you get government support for this. I think our systems are quite different.
Yes, I mean, I think Mary makes a very good point because in the end, if you like, trains are competing with cars and aeroplanes. And clearly, if you know, we're all used to, well, the vast majority of us are used to having a car, driving a car. We know kind of what the quality standard is of that car. And if you then get into a train and the seat's all ripped and broken, it's not really a very attractive alternative. So absolutely, if we're going to attract people to switch from cars or from aeroplanes onto trains, then there has to be a quality of service that actually makes it attractive to do so. I mean, the way it works in Europe is a combination of some services are commercially viable. That's to say, they don't need any subsidy. There are other services which do need some subsidy in order to keep them going. But typically, with high-speed services, they do make a profit. And they do have to be maintained to a high-quality standard, which enables them to be seen as an alternative to the aeroplane. Again, Mary was talking about, you know, people being on their mobile phones saying, oh, this is a whole new experience. And, you know, if you're a business traveler, then a journey from A to B, if you're flying, is usually wasted time. You cannot get any productivity out of it. You can't get very much work done. The great thing about high-speed rail is once that train journey starts, for the next 1, 2, 3 hours, you've got uninterrupted business time. There are many people here in Europe who talk about the fact that actually their most productive days are the days that when they go on high-speed rail. No one's interrupting them in the office. They simply take the laptop with them, or the BlackBerry or whatever it might be, and get 3 hours concentrated work done. So you're killing two birds with one stone, really, getting from A to B and doing a lot of work on the way.
Yeah. Is the upkeep on the high-speed rail expensive, Simon?
Well, I mean, nothing's cheap these days, is it? Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, it's expensive to maintain roads. It's expensive to maintain airports and railways as well. It's really a question of, have you got the revenues coming in to justify the expense of maintaining them? A Eurostar train, for instance, has 750 seats. Now, that's nearly two jumbo 747 jets. That's a lot of seats. We run those trains at a load factor of over 60%. That's to say more than 60% of the seats are full on every journey. Now, if you're carrying that number of travelers on every train, you know, you are getting in the revenues which justify the maintenance work that needs to be done on the tracks. But clearly, if you're running a train at nearly 200 miles an hour, you do have to build a good quality line that you know is safe to operate on, and you do have to maintain it. You can't just suddenly start lowering the speed limit because you're not quite sure about the condition of the track.
Right.
Because once you lower the speed limit, then your passengers are going to disappear.
Yes. Let's go to Richard from Sauk County. Hi, Richard.
Hello. 100% support of your system. I just want to relate. We were in Europe for our 25th anniversary 15 years ago, and we're going back for our 40th this fall. And we were there for a month 15 years ago, and we bought a Eurail pass, a month Eurail pass, and we just absolutely loved it. We got everywhere we wanted to go, and we got the just the joy or thrill of heading back to Paris. We hopped on, I believe it was out of from southern France, just shot right up to Paris, and was just awesome. So we plan on having that same experience again this fall, and we also like to ride the rails here in the United States as well. And so we're all for it. Any comment?
From me, Richard, my comment would be simply that you won't believe it when you come back, since you last were here 15 years ago, because whereas there was then and still is a good classic rail network, the big difference now in Europe is the huge expansion of the high-speed rail network. There are now high-speed lines all across France. They're building them all across Spain, where there's a huge high-speed network being planned. They're all over Germany. They're in Belgium. They're in Holland. They're in Italy. And so the speed with which you will get around Europe by rail will be much, much quicker when you come back for your 40th compared with your 25th anniversary.
Yeah, we're planning on southern France and Italy is what we're planning on this trip. So we didn't get enough of that last time. So
have a wonderful time.
Thank you,
Simon. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, I think, Richard, we'll see a lot more of high-speed rail. I think one of the challenges in Europe, again, because, of course, perhaps Europe, Western Europe is very broadly the same population and perhaps the same amount of land as the United States, but, of course, it's a dozen or more different countries and different languages. And one of the challenges is to knit together all the different high-speed networks. That's to say, on a map, it looks like a single network. But, of course, each country tends to sell its tickets by different ways, and each country, the trains perhaps look slightly different. And one of the things that we need to do in Europe, and which we are now doing, is bringing together all the different national high-speed systems and starting to turn it into a true pan-European network. Now, I think that's going to take us 5, 10, 15 years to really make that happen. But we have got an alliance now, an airline-style alliance in Europe called Rail Team, perhaps worth looking at their website. It's Rail Team, that's all one word. But that'll give you an indication of the kind of thinking that's going on in Europe about how to bring together the individual high-speed networks. Because I think it's a real challenge, perhaps. You know, if you're in the U.S. and you go to your travel agent or you go online, you're just thinking, well, I'll fly all around Europe.
Sure.
And it's only when you look at a map, you suddenly go, I don't need to fly between Paris and London. I can just take a train. It's quicker, it's simpler, it's more reliable, and actually I'll be enjoying the journey from the moment I get on the train, not from the waiting until I have to get off the aeroplane and see if I can still find my luggage.
Oh, you've sold us. You're so far ahead of us. I'm jealous. I'm jealous that you have this system and we're still struggling to figure out, well, do we need it or are we going to put another lane in the highway so we can all drive some more? It's a whole different way of doing things.
I think Phil was talking earlier about the fact that, you know, are there still people in the United States who actually know anything about high-speed rail, or are all the people who are doing the studies dying off? I say, don't be precious about these things. I mean, you know, look at the car industry. The Japanese imported ideas from other countries, and they now have a hugely successful car industry. Why can't the United States go to Europe, go to Asia, right, import the ideas that other countries have got, steal them, and make them your own? That's what everybody else does. Don't be shy.
Yeah, don't be shy. Thanks, Simon, so much. It was a great conversation. Thank you. Simon Montague, with us this half hour, Director of Corporate Communications for Eurostar. That was great, wasn't it? Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Rob Schroeder. This is the Ideas Network.